From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, President Trump's new budget out today. Both Democratic and GOP lawmakers are calling it dead on arrival.
Our lawmakers aren't going to be happy that their constituents are going to be hung out to dry in this budget proposal, so they'll be pushing back hard.
Using nonviolent communication to help heal a divided country.
And once we make someone an other, we tend to dehumanize them, and then it's really easy to disconnect and not be interested.
How one West Michigan school district is responding to 6 student deaths by suicide.
We felt like we needed to try and do something to be more proactive instead of always reacting to the situation.
And small business districts in Detroit barely hanging on. What's ahead for them? Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Military spending and high earners win. Social safety net programs in the Great Lakes lose. That's one broad takeaway from President Trump's budget plan released earlier today. Let's see what this Trump budget proposal could mean for Michigan as we say hello to Dustin Walsh of Crane's Detroit Business. We're talking a $4.1 trillion budget, Dustin. So how does Michigan fare?
Well, I don't think anyone fares quite well. I mean, you're looking at something that could be considered austerity measures in other parts of the world, but some of the big cuts are definitely going to be in Medicaid and nutrition assistance and our basic welfare and disability programs.
Even though candidate Trump promised he wouldn't cut Medicaid.
That is true. That is accurate. And apparently he's had a change of heart.
What are we talking about amount-wise and money-wise?
Well, I mean, you're looking at $3.6 trillion in cuts over 10 years. But as far as Medicaid goes, you're looking at $800 billion. Nutrition assistance, which includes food stamps, you're looking at $192 billion and $272 billion overall welfare programs, and then another $72 billion in disability benefits, another $9.2 billion in cuts to education. So you're seeing kind of cuts across the board here.
And we had received a clear signal a little earlier on that the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was in the crosshairs of the Trump budget. And how did that fare?
Same as it was. It looks like it's going to be sunset over 10 years. So it's a small $300 million, but it goes a long way in the Great Lakes states, the 8 Great Lakes states. And that looks like that'll no longer be the case.
And the politics of that, you certainly had lawmakers from both sides of the aisle from Michigan speaking out to save the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, if not other things.
Right. And I think that you're going to see pushback on that continued. Trump won 5 out of the 8 Great Lakes states in the election. So I think you're going to have kind of a unified Great Lakes region pushing pretty hard against those cuts because they are really critical to really basically the health and welfare of our residents, but also economic development.
And as funding for the safety net programs is cut, where are the dollars going to in the Trump budget?
Well, the majority of them are going to defense spending. That's going to be increased $54 billion. But we're not sure. I mean, it's making a lot of projections on what's going to save the budget. You know, we're looking at things that are being assumed. Some are calling it wildly optimistic projections on economic growth that stem from the passing of the House passed healthcare bill, which hasn't happened yet. It hasn't even moved to the Senate until probably later this week. And then we're looking at what's projected to be more spending from businesses after they receive tax reform, after they receive a 15% corporate tax rate. All those are wildly optimistic things that we're not sure are going to happen yet.
Now, Dustin, you mentioned the defense spending increase. There's also a lot of money and a big increase for infrastructure spending.
Yep, $200 billion. The hope is that that would be spurred by private investment up to $1 trillion over 10 years. I think everyone wants that. There's going to be a lot of positioning, particularly in the business community, to get access to those funds. There's definitely room for movement there. You know, it's sort of pulling from one pot and putting into the next. But everyone knows, particularly in Michigan, that we are in dire need of infrastructure spending. So I think that'll be met glowingly from a lot of the states like Michigan.
Now, there was something interesting in the budget that you pointed out in your piece for Crane's Detroit Business, paid parental leave. What's this budget got for that?
So that's something that Trump mentioned a lot on the campaign, and he was going to have his daughter Ivanka kind of lead the way because we are one of 2 countries in the world that doesn't offer some sort of paid parental leave as a mandate. So what they're hoping is they're going to be able to save $40 billion by limiting the earned income tax credit, basically by requiring everyone to have a Social Security number, a valid Social Security number, which would make illegal immigrants not able to capitalize on that.
Okay.
So the $40 billion there, they would take $19 billion of that and then put it towards 6 weeks paid for new parents and adopted.
Mothers and fathers.
Mothers and fathers. So we don't know what whether that's going to be 6 weeks for everyone. We assume that, but it's still to be determined.
So talk about the politics and the process, because we already have members of Congress speaking up to say this thing is dead on arrival. What are the nuts and bolts of what happens now?
Well, now it's going to move. You know, it's on their desk. And again, this is more of a wish list from the presidents. Almost every single presidential budget is dead on arrival when it reaches Congress. Really, what I think the hope here is that it's sort of a scorched earth budget. You know, here's the extreme of what we want. If Republican Congress can kind of push it somewhere toward the middle, then maybe everyone will be happy that they weren't cut all the way down to the bone. Still, that's still a pretty hard ask. So it's going to go to them. It's going to be put in committee. It's going to take some time. Eventually, both houses of Congress will have to agree on a budget. It likely will look nothing like this.
Bottom line, Michigan helped to put Donald Trump in the White House. How do we feel his first budget treated our state?
I don't think it treated it very kindly. I think what you've seen in Michigan is a really big swing towards, particularly if you look at even how businesses feel. Healthcare is a big issue. They want affordable healthcare, but they want good healthcare because that is to offer their employees, because that is a good motivating tool. It's a recruitment tool. So I think this is going to put more pressure on them, depending on what happens with the healthcare bill. And then you look at environment, everyone's pretty much on board with making our environment better here in Michigan, particularly in light of what's going on in Flint. I don't think they'll view that very kindly. We have a lot of people that require the social safety nets. Our lawmakers aren't going to be happy that their constituents are going to be hung out to dry in this proposal, in this budget proposal. So they'll be pushing back hard. And if you look at what's going on with disability, I mean, we're talking about 300,000 more people in Michigan are going to be on disability by 2030 as baby boomers age and just different things. Cuts to disability is not going to go over favorably with voters, particularly those that may need it in the future.
Dustin Walsh with Crane's Detroit Business with us via Skype. Dustin, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
The Republicans who control the state legislature today introduced bills that would end the use of pensions for public school employees hired after September 30th and put them into 401k plans to save for retirement. The bills proposed today in the House and Senate are identical. And this puts GOP legislative leaders in opposition to the governor. We've got Zach Gorchow of Gongra News Service here with us from Lansing. So both bills are identical. Zach, what message are legislative leaders trying to send?
I think they're trying to show we're working on this, we're coordinating. We're not just going to go off and do our own thing with the House doing one thing and the Senate doing another. We're putting a big priority on this.
And what are the main takeaways from these bills?
No big surprise with how the bill looks. It would end the current hybrid system that has some pension benefit and some 401k benefit for all public school employees hired after September 30th. And it would put them all into a 401k system. I guess the new news here is how that 401k system would work. The state would contribute an amount equal to 4% of their pay, and then the employees could have up to a 3% contribution with the state matching that amount as well.
I want to be real clear. Currently, we have two pension plans, the one for people hired before 2010, which has an unfunded liability of $29 billion and is not taking on additional people. And then there's this hybrid plan you referred to, whose enrollees came after 2010, and that's fully funded. And the governor said, hey, this is working. So what arguments are Republican leaders making for changing this hybrid system?
They are focusing on that $29 billion unfunded liability figure, but closing the hybrid plan to new employees is not going to reduce that because, as you said, the unfunded liability is all in the older pension systems that are not taking any new employees anyway. Another argument they're making is that 401k is more portable. Now, what they're not saying that the current system does allow employees who leave state public school employee service before fully vesting after 10 years to keep the contributions they are making to their pension portion of their plan. There's also an interest component they get to keep with that. Now, it is not quite as generous a deal as you would get if you were in the 401k, but it's not far off either. The other thing they're saying, which I think is probably the best argument they have, is that it would reduce uncertainty, that a pension system is inherently reliant on the stock market to be growing. While the hybrid system is fully funded now, if the stock market contracts, and maybe the better term is when, since the stock market will contract at some point, there would be unfunded liability that starts to accumulate because it's not growing to accommodate what the pension plan has promised. So that's one of their big arguments, is it gets rid of the uncertainty.
And what's the Democratic argument against this?
This is taking away a much better retirement income vehicle. It's pretty well proven. If you look at the state 401k system for state employees, their savings are not very good. People need to keep the income they're getting and can't afford to set some of it aside for retirement. The pension system is, you know, much more generous, means a more secure retirement for people. And they're saying, hey, look, the system is fully funded. Why would we mess with this? And for what? You're not going to touch that $29 billion in unfunded liability. You're just taking away a benefit and making becoming a teacher less attractive of a career option at a time when most teachers are getting minimal to no raises anyway.
House Speaker Tom Leonard and Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff have called off budget talks with Governor Snyder indefinitely, saying they want to see more progress on teacher pensions first. So how might this affect whether the budget gets done by June, which, of course, we know everyone's targeting?
This is a game of chicken. You know, how much is the governor going to insist upon meeting that arbitrary, but in his mind, magical early June deadline to finish the budget? Though there are consequences to not finishing it before July 1st, because schools run on a July 1 to June 30th fiscal year, and that creates some problems for them if they don't know exactly what they're going to be getting. That goes for local governments and universities and community colleges, too. So if he insists on getting it done by June 1, maybe he budges off of his opposition to this legislation. By the same token, how much are Arlen Meekhoff and Tom Leonard willing to go to the mat on this? Are they willing to have the budget go into the summer and early fall because they want to get this done? You know, how much are they willing to test the governor? It's not really clear just how dug in each side is. Other than that, the governor has said for a long time he believes the hybrid system is working and opposes going to a 401k system.
Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service. Thanks so much, Zach.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are small business districts throughout the city of Detroit that are barely hanging on. They were once thriving, but population loss and loss of wealth in their neighborhoods have hit most of them pretty hard. The question is, what to do with them now? Michigan Radio's Lester Graham reports for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative.
In the Morningside neighborhood, the main business strip is East Warren Avenue.
East Warren used to be a major shopping spot.
There were businesses in every building on Warren.
No matter what you needed, you could find it on Warren Avenue. The grocery stores, the movie theater.
A tailor, or a woodworking store, Five and Dime, whatever.
These are all business owners who still run decades-old businesses on East Warren. They say back in the day, it was so busy that finding a place to park was difficult and the sidewalks bustled into the evening. Riding along with him in his car, Eric DeWicke shows me the Warren Avenue strip in Morningside today.
I'd guess 50% are boarded up, and then you see all these vacant spaces here. This is where buildings have recently been torn down.
DeWicke is a lecturer in urban and regional planning at the University of Michigan. He also lives in Morningside.
Really, this is a problem all over Detroit of what do we do with our former retail strips that there really isn't a demand for.
Demand is also down because there's not as much wealth in the neighborhood. Firefighters, police officers, teachers, they once owned the homes in Morningside. They left. Many of the people here are now renters. Bill Kamen runs the Hammer Time True Value Hardware Store.
It's about not having money to buy stuff around here. They're spending 60, 70% of their money on rent, and they don't have the extra money to be working on houses and putting into stuff.
And without disposable income, it's risky for new businesses there. Marilyn Nash Yazbek is the owner of Nottingham Pharmacy. She's one of the few African-American business owners in Morningside.
I'm not really sure what will really thrive here because of the economics of the area. I think that has a lot to do with it.
The celebrated economic boom happening in downtown Detroit is not spilling over into the neighborhoods. Patrick Maher is with Eastside Locksmiths. It's been operating in Morningside since 1939. He says the area just needs a kickstart.
I understand that everybody wants to put the money downtown, but I mean, and not knowing a whole lot about a lot of the other neighborhoods, but knowing a lot about this particular one, we need some help.
What kind of help? Brian Pekulik has some ideas. He was the last president of the Business Association before it folded several years ago. He runs Bike Tech a little farther east on Warren. He'd like the city to do a few things.
To quickly and efficiently take care of the abandoned buildings, board it up, keep the neighborhood clean, safe, and lit.
But Bill Kamen at Hammer Time Hardware is not sure now is the right time to help Morningside.
I don't think that this side of Detroit has hit bottom yet. So maybe throwing good money after bad where the other neighborhoods are showing signs of a rebirth or something, that money might be better used in those areas than here.
That's not a sentiment many of the residents share. They've seen a few new stores open along East Warren Avenue in Morningside. They seem to be doing well. The residents are hoping for more, and they want the city of Detroit to do what it can to encourage that development. For the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
All through the presidential campaign, certainly since the election and through these first months of Donald Trump's presidency, Americans have been wrestling with anger, with disappointment and frustration with friends and family who supported the other candidate. Friendships have soured, family get-togethers can be strained or openly hostile if political disagreements erupt. One way to bridge this divide could be NVC, nonviolent communication, also known as compassionate communication. Ann Arbor social worker Lisa Gottlieb teaches nonviolent communication at the Washtenaw County Youth Center. Lisa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
How have you seen the election of President Trump affecting people's relationships with family and friends as you talk to people and meet people? What are you picking up?
I think it's been going on even before the election, where the polarities of people's opinions and their fears really took over, even at a minimum courteous discourse with each other. It seems in many ways that it's getting worse as people become more divisive and more hostile to each other, and then it's a harder gap to bridge.
Let's take a listen to what some randomly chosen people on the street had to tell us about the mood after the election.
Well, my opinion is everybody has their own prerogative, their own perspective, and I just feel like, you know, whatever you want to believe in, you can. I'll believe mine and you believe yours, and I don't have a bad attitude about people that don't agree with me politically.
It's hard to find anybody who agrees with me. Can't really change people's minds, so I just try to have a discussion, say what I got to say, listen to what they have to say, and hope for the best.
My reference would be my favorite location, which is Deer Camp, where I hunt with a bunch of Republicans who I love dearly, and we are able to put the animosity aside and have an intelligent conversation. And the best part about it is that we don't have to agree, but we all concede that our motivation is a better country. That while we might not agree on the path that we're on then or now, that all of us at a personal level want success that benefits all. And that allows us to have interesting conversations.
My friends who have different political views tend to think I'm coming on too harsh or preaching at them, and they tend to end the discussion, which I find frustrating because I like to talk to people that I know, that I appreciate, that I know have different views, but it's hard.
So you can't discount someone because of their opinion. You just have to be kind of thoughtful, but also realize that they need to do the same in return. Now, answer me this. Does that always happen? No, because that's an emotional topic. You know, religion and politics you don't bring up in polite company.
You know, I actually do have opportunities to talk to folks with opposing viewpoints in a very civil manner, and we tend to lay our thoughts on the table and not try and convince the other guy.
I think about I've got this image of our country, different factions, each side in its own corner, in its own silo, completely convinced that they are completely on the right and sharing things on Facebook and Twitter to support their views. And I see people doing it an awful lot, even to the point where I find myself feeling inundated by the pro or the anti post. And I find myself hiding the post. Other people have said they've done a lot of unfriending on Facebook. How is social media affecting all of this, do you think?
Well, I think anytime there's an opportunity for people to be anonymous or to post something without actually considering who might be reading it, they often feel more free to be hostile or divisive or name call or insulting. My sense is, and this is from through the lens of nonviolent communication, that people are getting caught up in the conflict around their strategies, and that with nonviolent communication, we really look at universal human needs. And we attempt to touch into where all our needs overlap, because otherwise we create a situation where we look at people who disagree with us as others. And once we make someone an other, we tend to dehumanize them. And then it's really easy to disconnect and not be interested.
Let's talk about nonviolent communication. What are the elements of this?
The primary elements of nonviolent communication are to hold the idea of universal human needs and connecting through empathetic listening and sharing as key to communication. So someone recently said to me that nonviolent communication is an operating system for life disguised as a communication device. And in some ways, I think it's true. Marshall Rosenberg, who founded nonviolent communication, who actually moved to Detroit a week before the 1948 race riots, he was a teenager and he was really influenced by those riots, both because he was Jewish and because he saw how people of color were being treated. And that affected him for the rest of his life. And his work was about bridging gaps, racial and social equality. And he went on to get a doctorate in psychology and create nonviolent communication as a protocol. So there, he also studied Buddhism and Eastern philosophy. So a lot of that is some overlap with the idea of compassion for ourselves, compassion for other people, as a way to actually see someone for their whole selves, and connecting with the idea that we all share the same human universal needs.
Which we did hear from some of the folks we spoke with, and I guess that's something to hang our hats on as I ask you, looking through the lens of nonviolent communication, what's going on when someone said, I cannot believe that all my friends have voted for Trump. They're happy with what he's doing. I can't even look them in the eye. I don't even want to be around them. What's ticking there? And how do you break beyond that to start to heal?
Yeah, well, I think that that's part of being judgmental and evaluative of other people, which is our natural tendency. And there's a place for that. We need judgment and evaluation if something's dangerous. If there's a car speeding towards me, I want to act quickly to get out of that way of that dangerous car. Yet in most situations, if we can actually step back and be curious about what someone else is actually needing in a situation, as opposed to looking at their strategies to meet their needs. So when I think about someone who wasn't happy with the choice of president, my guess is that I would touch into maybe their feelings first, that they're feeling frightened, that they're having some concern about safety for people they might care about or even other people they don't know but want equality. And so the needs associated that might be some security and predictability and safety and also a sense of being considered, their feelings and needs being considered. What they're doing is they're striking out against someone because that's our natural tendency. Through the lens of nonviolent communication, they might instead consider what first are their own feelings and needs. So less about what someone else is doing or not doing to them or to others. Instead, what's coming up for them from the feelings and staying with the feelings just long enough to connect with their needs, what they want. Then, if their needs are for safety and security, say, they might actually have some curiosity about what someone who's on the opposite side of the argument might want. In a conversation, it might find out that that person who voted differently than them actually shares the same needs for security and predictability, wanting to take care of their family, wanting to have a voice and be heard. So when people can actually connect on the shared needs, then there's a lot of room, there's a lot of space cleared to creatively think of strategies to work together.
What might be some opening phrases? What are some things that you might give us to be able to say to kind of break that cycle of being mad or being defensive? Because we hear from people who voted for Mr. Trump, especially after the election, people who said, I don't dare say anything. I'm getting pounced on. So what are some things we might say to kind of break that?
Yeah, well, I would say first, let me back up for a moment and say, even though it's nonviolent or compassionate communication, there is room in this protocol for every possible feeling, from rage to disgust and revulsion to bliss and delight. So it's really a matter of touching into the feelings, figuring out the needs associated with those feelings, and then purposely deciding what action to take. For example, if I'm speaking with someone and I start to notice I'm provoked by something they're saying, the first thing I'm going to want to do is give myself some empathy. I'm going to touch into my own sense of upset and connect with what I'm needing in that moment, which might just be a pause to calm myself down. Then when I'm more calm and I've given myself some empathy, I have a little more headroom, say, to actually be curious about someone else. Now, often offering someone with a differing opinion just a little bit of empathy can begin to bridge that gap. Now, I can offer someone empathy without agreeing with them. And that's the beginning of the bridge.
Because there's a sturdy presence on social media, Facebook and Twitter in particular, of the resistance. People who are organizing through social media to express their sentiments of he is not my president or planning action and planning demonstration. So I was wondering, can resistance live side by side with an attempt to understand that person who voted otherwise? And I'm hearing you say it can.
Yes, I don't think it's easy to do. I mean, the protocol of nonviolent communication is pretty simple. Doing it takes tremendous amounts of effort and practice. For me, I think it's worth it. I think the option to that is a disaster, to keep going in this way where there's divisiveness and an inability to actually talk to each other and have a safe space for everyone. This is what we're really working towards. So yes, I think that someone can have very strong opinions and work very hard towards social issues that are important to them and still consider that someone who disagrees with them has their own humanity. We may not understand it. However, being curious and leaning into that idea of what might actually be important to that person, what do they value, what is important, and connecting at that level.
Lisa, how have you seen through your work, seen NVC changing people or changing communities?
I love that question because I think it's a really practical question and people are looking for practical tools to make things different. And there's a lot of beauty of that with nonviolent communication. It's kind of a consciousness and a philosophy, but it also has practical tools for communication. And I talk a lot with people who have really different points of view. And what I've found is that when I am using the protocols of nonviolent communication, to be curious, to listen empathetically, to offer empathetic responses, people soften a little bit and open up a little bit more. And I see this over and over, even with people with strong disagreements, that when most everyone has a need to be heard and to be understood and seen for their intentions, this is a way for people to have that need met. So I see it at work in my daily life. I see it in practice groups that I lead. I see it in workshops. And then I see it just out in the world talking to people with various points of view.
And interestingly, nonviolent communication, it's very big in Ann Arbor, but you're saying it isn't kind of as well known throughout the rest of Michigan.
Well, yes. I mean, there's a presence in Detroit. Mm-hmm. But about 3 years ago, I was going to workshops in Ohio and really thought, wait a second, if Ohio's doing this, it happened to be in Columbus. I was like, no, we want this in Ann Arbor too. So I work with Jeff Brown, a trainer in Columbus, Ohio, and Francois Beausoleil, a trainer in Quebec. And they come to Ann Arbor and we do lots of workshops. And I'm feeling really excited about Ann Arbor being a real hub for compassionate communication in the Great Lakes area.
Well, anyone who wants to find out more about training and more about compassionate communication can go to this website, centerfornonviolentcommunication.org. Ann Arbor School social worker Lisa Gottlieb, thank you so much for introducing us to nonviolent communication.
Thank you, Cindy, for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
And for those who want to learn more about nonviolent communication, there is a workshop in Ann Arbor June 2nd and 3rd. Get more information at cnvc.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When a teen is wrestling with mental health issues, even thinking of suicide, the stigma associated with mental illness often keeps him or her from reaching out for help. And that's why the culture and climate at a school is so critical. Teachers and administrators who know the warning signs and know what to do next to support their students. Grand Haven Public Schools have experienced this challenge. Six of their students have died by suicide between the fall of 2011 to the fall of 2016. And for Grand Haven High School principal Tracy Wilson, this is very personal. She lost her father to suicide 21 years ago. Tracy Wilson, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be invited.
That is quite a mind-blowing blow that you've taken in Grand Haven Public Schools with six students dying by suicide since 2011. And in that time, you've both been an assistant principal, now you're a principal. When it comes to the way a school community responds, how are suicide deaths different from other student deaths?
Well, I think that it's really critical to note that even though we try to be consistent in how we handle every student death, people struggle with what to do, what to say, how to reach out to families when it's a death by suicide. And so I think it's really important as educators that we try hard to treat that family no different than we would if they lost a student or a son or a daughter to a traffic accident, for example. We wrap our arms around people. We cater to them. We want to bring food to them. We want to do all kinds of things. But when it's a suicide, we tend to stand back and wait to follow the lead of the family. You know, my experience would be it doesn't matter what you say. You can't really make a mistake. The bigger mistake is made in just being silent and not reaching out at all. So I will just call the family and offer my condolences immediately, and then also find out from them how and what they would really like us to be able to share. You know, it's not like when there's a car accident, everybody knows there was an accident and we lost somebody based on that situation. There's always rumors that get started, and so I just want to clarify with the family, you know, what can be shared, what can be corrected, and how comfortable they are with the situation.
And then as an administrator, you have a student body to consider as well.
We do. We are near 2,000 students in our building, and unfortunately, the social media monster doesn't help us whatsoever. Things are posted, and kids are finding out some information before we even are, and then that's how things get blown up. And oftentimes, when the students arrive to school, the information they're arriving to school with isn't even necessarily fact. It's, you know, they're coming up with and spinning and making things up, and it just becomes a monster that we have to deal with. And so that's why it's really critical that I have the ability to communicate with somebody in the family. But I try to be very sympathetic. I try to be very empathetic. I share, you know, that I do understand where they're at. I do understand how they're feeling. I might not be the parent, but I've been in the situation of finding out the news, and so I want to be very sensitive to how they're feeling around what other people know as well.
Tracy, you've come a long, long way at Grand Haven High School in addressing mental health issues and suicide since 2011, because back then you kind of faced some resistance in addressing this issue. And I'm wondering, who was reticent and why?
So we lost our first student, and it was actually in the spring of 2011. So we started that new school year off in the fall of 2011, which was my first year as the building principal. I had transitioned that July from an assistant principal to principal role. And all the while, that was in my mind that we had lost this student by way of suicide, and I wanted to know what we could do as a building and how we could start having conversations and educating people. And honestly, if you think back even to 2011, although it doesn't seem that long ago, conversations around mental health and around suicide weren't had by anybody. And so when I broached that topic and I brought in somebody from the Mental Health Foundation of West Michigan, we listened, but everybody that sat and listened to that conversation, I could just feel some resistance or some uneasiness or uncomfortableness. And I, being in my first year as a building principal, didn't really push hard on we need to do this. I knew in my heart that if we don't start opening up doors in order to have conversations, it would be an uncomfortable conversation always. And so the stigma around mental health, I believe, in our country, in the ability to have conversations, has softened a lot since 2011. So when we lost a young lady prior to graduation in March of 2015, that's when I started to have some conversation with our psychologists and social workers here in the building. And then our director of special education is our crisis team leader for the district. And so, you know, she and I started to have some conversations around what could we do and what kinds of things should we be looking at. And then right after graduation in 2015, we lost another young lady who had just graduated. So the young lady in March of 15 would have been a graduate, and the young lady in June of 15 was a graduate.
So two from the same class.
Two from the same class. And so that's basically when I called our director of special ed and I said, okay, something has to happen immediately. I was in that, we've got to put something in place right now, and we've got to do this, this, and this. And we're always dealing with, of course, what would we want to do, and what would we be looking at, and what would the cost be involved in? And for me, you know, if you're going to do a curriculum or not a curriculum, and it's only about the dollar, you know, I struggle with that, because dealing with students socially and emotionally in today's world is so critical. So she and I sat down and looked at what might an initiative with a district of 6,400 kids look like. So we pulled in four social workers from our district. And so the six of us started in June of 15 to look at what do we need to do? What do we need to research? Where do we need to go? Our teachers in my building, you know, that was the third high school student. So my teachers were asking for, how do we even talk to kids when they come to us? We don't even know how to support students in crisis when it's related to a suicide. So they were asking for more help.
So that reticence that you kind of felt when you first broached that, had the needle had moved, hadn't it?
Absolutely. And we were at the same time these things were going on. We were just getting ready on July 1 to transition into a brand new superintendent as well. Not knowing the new superintendent and what his mindset might be around something like this, we just continued to move forward with researching what is out there. So we actually started with the adults, like what kind of education could we give adults? And we found a program called QPR. It's Question, Persuade, and Refer. And it teaches warning signs of suicide, and it teaches you what to do and how to talk to people. And once we put some of those things in place and we shared it with our new superintendent when he was on board July 1, he was fully supportive of our efforts, and we became certified, and we put together a plan, a K-12 plan that would be systemic and something that would be able to be lasting.
Because you really want to get these kids willing to talk about mental health issues and look at their behavior toward each other, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, the culture that you need to create around students, and it starts at a young age. It's not just at the high school level, although we were experiencing the crisis at our level. You know, looking back, those students may have shown some signs earlier, and so we felt like we needed to try and do something to be more proactive instead of always reacting to the situation.
So what programs, initiatives for the students have you found to be very effective?
Really, at our building, at the high school level, anything that students own and become involved in, our students have glommed onto. So at the high school, some of our students that have been leaders, that have been around the situation, they have created a couple different opportunities. We have a class called Pay It Forward for seniors, and we had a group of Pay It Forward seniors last school year that, number one, created a golf outing that would be a way to raise funds to support any kind of ongoing education with students. And then we had another group that created a lesson that was called Love a Buck, Help a Buck. And they had five different high school seniors that actually spoke in front of the entire student body. We did four different assemblies, and they just shared their own personal experiences with different kinds of mental health struggles and how treating one another is so critical and important.
And the team name is the Buccaneers, right?
Yeah, that's our school. Yep, we're the Buccaneers. So what's critical, I think, to help people understand is that when a student has been out of school for a week and they come back into school on crutches, we hover around that student and we ask, is there anything you need? But when a student has been out of school for a week and you might hear that they're having some mental health struggles, oftentimes we say nothing to them. Our kids are afraid to say, how are you doing? And that barrier is really what we wanted to break. We wanted kids to reach out to each other no matter why they were out of school. We didn't want them to be afraid to ask their peer how they're doing. And so I think by having peers share about their own individual struggles and telling the rest of the student body that, number one, it's okay to ask for help, and number two, don't be afraid of saying something wrong in front of somebody who's having a struggle, that by reaching out to them, you're helping them just by asking them how they're doing.
Tracy, I know that your father died by suicide a little more than 20 years ago, and you only shared that story publicly with your student body and your faculty 2 years ago, 2015. Was it because of the losses within your school? Did that motivate you?
Absolutely. I will tell you that that summer when I told you that we kind of got our team together and we started to create a plan for our full district, and so part of that in creating that plan for our district, that team said, they asked if I would speak and share my story with the rest of the school employees at our opening day. They felt that by putting a personal face on something as sensitive as mental health and suicide, that it would help our staff realize the importance of being open to having these kinds of conversations.
What was that like for you?
Oh my gosh, I can't even tell you. I had no idea what I was in for, to be quite honest, and I was nervous to share, and I really didn't know what to say, but when I got up on the microphone, I just spoke from my heart. My building was under construction that summer, and so we actually held our opening day at our middle school, and I was standing on stage in front of the entire district in the very building that I was teaching in 1996 when my dad died. Mm. And so, you know, I got off that stage after I shared my story, and my assistant principal was my assistant volleyball coach at the time and has been a friend and a colleague of mine all these years. And he said to me, you know, you said some things up there that I've never heard before. And I said, I don't even know what I said up there. Mm. I felt like the weight of the world was taken off my shoulder. I was hanging on to stuff for so long. It's been a pretty emotional roller coaster, I'll be honest with you. And because suicide is such a tender topic, people didn't ask me about it. People didn't ask me how I was doing. You know, the one thing I will say to you that I've learned over all the years is I can absolutely tell you the difference in a facial expression or a response that I have gotten from people when they ask me, you know, however it comes up, your parents, and I say, well, you know, my father's no longer living. Well, how did your father die? If my response, which my response was for a lot of years, he committed suicide compared to he suffered from depression and he died by suicide, the different facial expressions that you get when you use the word committed, it seems like that person did a crime. And so I just don't think that people are, over the years, have been as understanding. When I say my dad suffered from depression and he died by suicide, the reaction is completely different.
You're right. We don't say committed cancer.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, for me, that's just been a piece of myself, my own personal growth, and that's just kind of what I share with people. If I ever hear someone say committed suicide, it's like the hair goes back on, you know, up on the back of my neck, mm-hmm. and I try to very politely educate people that, you know, first of all, how someone dies shouldn't define who they are or were as a person. And people don't ask to have mental illness, just like they don't ask to have cancer. It is a disease, and we are only now, as a country, willing and able to have conversation around it without putting a label or a stigma on someone that I do think still exists. We're not 100% there. We are certainly farther ahead than we used to be.
Tracy, I'm interested, when you think back, is there anything that you wished you had done differently that perhaps other schools could learn from?
I guess the only thing that I would say is I wish that we were able to start where we are today years ago. You know, we do a lot of things in our district that are systemic and sustainable. We have a program called Capturing Kids' Hearts that we started back in, 2009, and that's a program that really focuses on the relationship building that needs to happen between the adult and the kids in the classroom, between the bus driver and the kids on the bus, between the students and each other. And I just think that the climate that we create in schools has to be such that it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from, you belong, you're welcomed, and you're accepted. It doesn't cost any money to show kindness to someone else. Random acts of kindness might change the trajectory of someone's life. And so we have a new club that started this year with a group of freshmen, which is our DORAC, which is Do Random Acts of Kindness. They started this club because they just want to continue to grow that empathy and compassion in our students. And when we empower our kids, I mean, they just run with it.
You've dealt with this issue more than many schools have, and you've done these cool initiatives to get the kids thinking and talking about mental health. What still keeps you up at night?
The fact that we can't save them all. You can't save everybody, and that, for me, is the hardest piece of it. And for me, that's the biggest struggle. We can be kind, and we can tell people we love them, and we can do everything possible, but at the end of the day, we can't save everybody.
Tracy Wilson, principal at Grand Haven High School. Thank you so much, Tracy, for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.